General Government Subcommittee, July 23rd, 1999, 9 a.m., hearing 174.
Subcommittee, the subcommittee of the General Government Ways and Means, and we've had folks up here testifying. What we need to do is we need to get some information from the bonding companies, and then any follow-up and wrap-up questions that members of the committee may have this morning. And what we'd like to do is, let me find that list. We had Dave and Tom Burrows that were signed up for Tom here.
What?
I had it with me. I took it out on the
water.
This world's welcome. I apologize. We now have the sufficient senators and sufficient members of the House to call this a subcommittee of Ways and Means. So,
Barrows.
Not Burrows.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Tom Burrows, representing Freightliner Corporation. Our interest in this is in the Dash A5 amendments, lines 1 and 2, which would do what I think the original intent of the bill was, which is take heavy trucks out of the definition of dealership. My understanding is the intention was not, especially with line 17 of the Angra bill, and the original bill was to exclude heavy trucks, but the term exclusively in that line would bring Freightliner in because they also manufacture some school buses which do not fall under the tax listed there. My understanding is there's no opposition to the amendment to exclude Freightliner or to exclude heavy trucks in that manner.
Do we each have a copy of the proposed amendments? I don't know whether they were handed out. This is the Dash A5 amendment. Okay. You didn't receive them?
No.
Okay. We'll need to. Let me give. That's my copy that I received from the Barrows. Let's go with Barrows. Right?
Barrows.
I beg your pardon. We've got the GAROWS, Eastern Oregon and Navy. It's Barrows.
It's a Barrows.
I'll get the Dash A5 amendments. Last night, relative to the A5 amendments, this bill was not heard, but it was tapped in, I understand, Commerce. And so I met with Representative Hill from Commerce last night relative to the A5 amendments, and he has approved the A5 amendments for inclusion into the bill. So,
just a question about the A5 amendments. Tom, why does it make sense to exclude these trucks from this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cho, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think originally this bill was written with the idea of dealing with car dealerships, and so they're trying to sort of carve out some of the down in that section who isn't a dealer, and just the wording by using exclusively rather than primarily. I think for the reason that it wasn't written with that in mind, it may not make sense. Also, I think if a heavy truck manufacturer or dealership went out of business, I think it would the numbers we're talking about here really wouldn't amount to much.
I think they really didn't intend to include to begin with and just did it so by accident, so you need an exclusion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's my understanding, and Mr. Shepard, Mr. LaFleur could probably answer that more clearly, but that's my understanding that it was such a...
Okay. Any further questions relative to heavy-duty trucks and equipment for Mr. Barrow? If not, thank you very much, Tom. We appreciate you having you here. And we've all now had an opportunity, and I sincerely beg your pardon. I thought that in my conversation yesterday with Mr. Fuller, he indicated that he had given out the A5 amendments when he introduced his made his primary introduction and remarks. I beg your pardon. I had received a copy from Mr. Harrell's, and that was the only copy I had in my file. So, and then I did record that there are some of my hand scratch notes as to what happens relative to a lawsuit. But the committee that this has been heard by the House committee was the Consumer Affairs, House Commerce, and Representative Hill has indicated that he would authorize the A5 amendments. When I approached him on the floor, he said that he knew of the A5 amendments and he would authorize them and would sign off. For the record, Mr. Fuller indicates that he has, Representative Hill has in fact signed off on a copy of the A5, and that Leslie has signed off and we're to get Senator Kim, so we'll discuss those as a part and parcel of the of House Bill 2734. Brian Bowe and John Powell. Apologize for being so disorganized. I didn't realize we just got busier and busier as we went through this. I thought if we worked really hard up front that we could be all done by the time we got to this point. I guess by way of introduction, we have received some information relative to the bonding issues, and I understand that you have come today to discuss the issue of dealer bonding and the insurance aspect of a dealership.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Contractors Bonding, an insurance company, a company that specializes in surety and bond. Mr. Chairman and members, let me begin by saying in the file folder that I handed you, there are two pieces. One begins by saying House Bill 2734 does two unrelated things. There's two pages there. And the next one says why we oppose House Bill 2734, and it's three pages long. It begins with a yellow highlighted section. And then there are a series of articles behind that which I will refer to in the testimony. And before I begin on this testimony, Mr. Chairman and members, I would simply like to respond to this handout that you discussed yesterday, showing the difference in cost between the bond and the recovery fund. Simply to note that this really is not an apples-to-apples comparison, because the bond currently, as it's instructed and as it pays out, pays for a whole series of things that the recovery fund would not pay for. For example, the bond responds to dealer-to-dealer complaints, whereas the recovery fund is limited only to purchasers of vehicles. Lending institutions file against this bond. In fact, about 80% of our payout of this bond go to non-consumers. You go to the banks, to auction houses where dealers have purchased cars and have not paid for them. So everybody in the system gets a claim against the bond. In the recovery fund, the comparison, only consumers, only about 15 to 20% of the claims would be allowed under that. So this comparison is kind of walnut to apple.
So the, if I may interrupt, the surety bond that we're talking about, that would be the $25,000 bond, which is presently covered in statute as a result of this 1999 Legislative Assembly, the $25,000 bond is consumer directed in part, but 20% or approximately 20% is consumer related. 80% would be non-consumer related.
Mr. Chairman, that's been the experience of Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company in terms of their payout. The vast majority of the money that they pay out goes to other businesses as opposed to consumers, only because those businesses have a right to make a claim against the bond. If that was limited, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in my testimony, there would be a methodology of limiting who has access to the bond, of course.
Very true.
Does that mean that the bond payment is not as responsive to the consumers as it needs to be?
Chairman Senator Trowe, it does not necessarily mean that. However, in cases where the bond, penal sum of the bond is insufficient, then the and there are numerous complaints.
The creditors still get all the bond money.
Right.
It's not bond money left for the consumer.
Right. Now, usually what would happen in a case like that, the court would make a decision as to who gets what amount. And in many cases, there are no...
consumer have to go to court to get in line?
Mr. Chairman, that's another difference. Currently, if on the face of it, a consumer has lost, they would not have to have a judgment to collect against the bond. And that's another difference between a recovery fund and a bonding company. Bonding companies spend a lot of time, a lot of resources trying to facilitate recovery so that the bond does not have to be activated. And that lowers the number overall of complaints. It's one of the things that you talked about in the last couple of days is, I think it was Mr. Shepard said that the consumers would be more careful, or dealers would be more careful under the Recovery Act because if there was a claim, they would lose the right to do business. Well, that's already the case because if they lose their bond, they lose their license as well. So that is already the case.
And basically, I think from Mr. Shepard's testimony, that's what I had written at the bottom of the proposed amendment, was that the process that a lawsuit needed to be filed, the consumer has to win, he has to get a judgment, he has to attempt the execution of the judgment, and then he goes to the state fund. But the full legal fees are limited and capped at $500 on uncontested or contested fees. So.
And Mr. Chairman, just briefly, to that amendment, I can talk more about that later. That's why I don't think it works to move the bond to behind the recovery fund because they're not synonymous. The bond covers things that the recovery fund does not. And by moving it behind that, since about 80% of our payout goes to others, it really doesn't shield the bond at all. And it would create a great deal of confusion to where people go to collect for certain things. So we don't think that amendment would work.
Well, let me ask this then. Are we saying then that with the recovery fund in place, because of the time that it takes to get to the recovery fund, that the other 80% folks could basically take out the bond? Is that what we're saying? The non-consumers?
Mr. Chairman, the bond, there is a possibility that the bond, if it could be exhausted prior to somebody getting through
to the recovery fund. So that could really, the recovery fund then becomes the would have to almost become the primary source at that particular point.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand those amendments, that's the purpose of those amendments, is to make the recovery fund the primary source, or the first. So I think, I believe that was the intent of that amendment, was to move that recovery fund up in front of the bond.
That'd be the new subparagraph 5, a consumer qualifies for payment from the fund must make a claim against the fund prior to attempting to collect any amount, any judgment entered into against the charity.
And Mr. Chairman, I just would indicate another thing. It's in my testimony here that can be discussed at more length when I get to it as well, is the fact that in the Virginia experience, they had a system where there was no bond, that their system was open to all claimants, like our bond is. That fund was depleted in 1994, and their legislature had to totally rewrite it. They put a bond back out in front for people in business for the first 3 years, or anybody that's had a claim, they had to carry bonds out in front of that, and their first full year under the new system was 1996, and I do have some information on what happened to that since. This the first two pages that I handed you really are to a certain extent repetitive of what you have already discussed, and I'll try not to repeat those all of the things. However, I do think it's important to cover some of it. As you know, as House Bill 2734 is sits before you, it does two really unrelated things. It creates a state-owned insurance company called the Recovery Fund for the purpose of paying claims and handling claims. The second thing is that it increases the titling fee by $10 per automobile. And it accomplishes those two things by creating a board appointed by the Department of Justice and Transportation, and the people they appoint in turn get together and appoint some remaining folks to be the governing board. The bill allows them to hire people to administer the program and that sort of thing, as you've already been told. Also, with the titling fee, there's an explanation there of about how many automobiles are sold a year, roughly 400,000, and what that would mean in the total increase in the amount of those fees that are paid. There was some discussion about who will pay for House Bill 2734, and the $5 charge that is in the bill to stimulate and initiate the fund. It was a very important provision of the bill and the discussion in the work group, and the used car dealers made it very clear that they did not want the language to prohibit them from passing that $5 on to the consumer. And the bill is written in such a way that although it says the dealer shall pay, it does not prohibit that fee from being passed on. And then only the new dealers who have 3 years or less of experience are assessed on their license fee surcharge for those first three renewals. In addition, the bill provides that any dealer who purchases a $250,000 bond is exempt from the fact. And so if you can see there on page 1, lines 12 through 16, where people that can purchase that kind of a bond are exempt. So given the Federated example, the Federated Insurance Company, who said they could sell these to the larger dealers for about under $1,300 a year, that would mean under the two provisions of this act, that premium would be paid for by the first 130 automobiles sold if you added $10 onto each car. So I would think that most of those dealerships would opt out of this act. From just a pure business standpoint, it would make sense.
Opt out of part of the act. The other part in which they get the titling fee increase they would get.
Right.
But they wouldn't any longer pay the state. They wouldn't have to pay the state the $5 fee.
Right.
they wouldn't pay the state the $650 first time fee or the interim fees,
but they would still
or the travel fees,
and they would get the
$45.
Yeah. They get the increase.
And so under 1560, under and basically that's the term does not include on line 14, the dealer, the term dealer does except that the term dealer does not include a dealer who voluntarily purchases bond or letter of credit in the amount of $250,000. At that point, they're totally excluded?
Mr. Chairman, that's from the definition of dealer. So anywhere in the bill where it says a dealer must do this or a dealer must do that, unless there's an exception to that, they would be exempt.
So,
and the theory under that is that they have this bond, this $150,000 bond, that consumers could file against. And that's the theory. But they'd be exempt from provisions.
And that bond would be the same kind of a surety bond that we're talking about presently. That's the $25,000 bond.
It
would just be 10 times more money available for, well, at 10 times more money, even at 20% going to consumers, it would still generate that much more money for consumers. And you say that, let's use the example of the $1,500 that would be paid for in the equivalent of how many automobiles?
Mr. Chairman, at $10 an automobile, actually the letter from Federated said it'd be less than $1,300, so the first 130 automobiles sold would pay for that premium that they would have to pay for that bond.
So a very small dealership, a used car dealership or something like that, that sold 20 cars a month or 15 cars a month, they would be
under the ass.
They would be ahead to spend the money and buy the $250,000 bond, and then they wouldn't be subject. Now, does that mean that they would not be subject to any of the $650, and then 2 years or 3 years later, the $300, or any of the special assessments that are provided for online and page 3 on line 13 and 14 of special assessment for the fund?
Chairman, I believe that's correct. And in addition, Mr. Chairman, members, one of the items in the bill that has not been discussed is that even the dealers who are new to the business, who are paying the $650 and $350 and $150 fee, there is a methodology in the bill for them to be paid that money back. You'll find that in Section 2, sub 3 on page 2. So it's page 2, lines 20 to 24. And that language says, under subsection 3, I quote, the interest earned in the fund shall be deposited to the credit of the fund until such time as the balance in the fund first exceeds $700,000. Interest earned after the date on which the balance first exceeds $700,000 shall be distributed annually by the board to dealers who apply for reimbursement of the fees that dealers previously paid to the fund pursuant to section 3 of this 1999 Act. So the provision, they can first draw on the interest earnings in terms of those fees they paid in to get reimbursement for.
Let me just ask, we do have a revised fiscal, and I'll ask for that in just a few moments here. But the one of the fees, I need to ask Crystal, once it exceeds, then it's on line 25, 26 through 28. The board shall first reimburse the first dealer who paid a fee, and the remaining dealers in succession in order until they're paid, and then the interest is exhausted, available for distribution, and interest not distributed as reimbursed shall remain in the fund. Tell me who does that, if you would, please, Susie.
Well, the recovery the board has to make that authorization, and then they would
make the calculations as to who first is that first in, first out. Is that your?
That's my understanding. Yes, and DMV is collecting the money, and they won't stop collecting the money until the board tells them that they've reached sufficient amount in the fund that they no longer need to collect it, and then they would have to set up a mechanism for refunding.
But the interest and any other accumulations in the funds can be used to pay the expenses of the board per your fiscal analysis.
Yes, they can.
Okay.
Sure.
So Representative Messerly,
I want to make sure I understand this, but not only is it first in, first out, but they also have to apply to receive those funds back. So it's an act of bureaucratic commitment.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the board would probably establish some administrative rules and procedures that would, lay out how they would accomplish that, so that everybody is aware of the process.
The board that we would be authorizing under the recovery fund would have administrative rule proceedings authority then. Okay. And
that's on page 3 in section 3, subsection 3.
Okay.
Page 3.
All right. And Mr. Chairman, then to the sunset provisions of the Act, as you know, the recovery fund portion of the Act sunsets January 1 of year 2004. The fee increase section does not sunset and also provides that by rule that fee can be increased above the $45 level as well. One of the concerns in the...
Little fee can be increased by the board?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. In section...
So we're moving away from it being statutorily approved. They don't have the authority to do that.
As I understand the language, Mr. Chairman, Senator Crowe, it creates a $45 floor. On page 9, lines 44 and 45, says the maximum charge for the service described in this section is $45 or such greater amount as the department may by rule permit.
So we're moving the rule from 35 to statutory 45, and then by rule, such greater amount as they may determine. But that's the portion which is kept by the dealership
for
the document preparation.
And that section is not sunset.
That does not sunset?
No. The sunset provision exempts section 14 is not sunset in that provision of the bill.
So section 16 talks about the sunset goes from sections 1 through 8 and 11 are repealed January 1st, 2004.
And the rest of it would remain in statute.
But does the governing board sunset too, so they wouldn't be able to do that?
They do, and that's one of the concerns. There is a provision for any excess monies left. They would go to the highway fund on the last section, section 19, lines 9 and 10 of page 11. However, there is no provision for what would happen if there are what you do with the tail of claims. Anytime you stop an insurance company, there are claims that are in process or coming in that occurred during that period of time. And I guess there would have to be some legislation passed at that time to deal with who is going to pick that up. Or if the fund, by chance, had insufficient funds in it at that time and those funds were pending, who might pay for those?
Since this would be a creation of the state, would the state be liable for anything left over?
Chairman, I would not be the proper one to answer that question. I know in other jurisdictions where the funds have had trouble, the state has had to step in. I could not answer from a legal question. So.
Maybe we could get Mr. Shepard just to come forward. I'm going to be fairly protective of the state highway fund. I was on the transportation, and I blocked that legislation going to the tapping the state highway fund for other kinds of things. Mr. Shepard, for the record, can you just identify yourself and tell us what would happen after 2004 when the state highway funds under section 19 would receive, tell us what may happen to the tail.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pete Shepard from the Oregon Department of Justice, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. I think that first of all, I don't think the state highway funds would properly be liable for these kinds of claims. It would not be the kind of thing that the Constitution would permit to be paid from the state highway funds. So I don't think that.
But the general fund.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I think that how I would read the bill is that assuming that the legislature met during the session in which the measure would sunset, didn't otherwise deal with the question, which Mr. Powell suggests, of course, is certainly a possibility. But assuming that that legislature did not do anything, how I would read the bill is that those consumers would have submitted claims that were not paid by the fund, and therefore they'd be thrown back on the bond to the extent the bond is available. And that would be the extent of the liability. I don't think that it wouldn't be my judgment that the state would have liability for payment of something that had not been, when the authority for those payments no longer existed in statute. That'd be my impression.
Is that true with
how I would read the bill is that, assuming that the legislature met during the session in which the measure would sunset, didn't otherwise deal with the question, which Mr. Powell suggests, of course, is certainly a possibility. But assuming that that legislature did not do anything, how I would read the bill is that those consumers would have submitted claims that were not paid by the fund, and therefore they'd be thrown back on the bond to the extent the bond was available. And that would be the extent of the liability. I don't think that it wouldn't be my judgment that the state would have liability for payment of something that had not been, when the authority for those payments no longer existed in statute. That'd be my impression.
Is that true with the DAC A5 amendments, though, that the bond, the new Part 5, the consumer qualifies for payments of the fund, must make a claim against the fund prior to attempting to collect any amount the judgment entered into against the surety bond that provides the dealer's bond or insured institution.
Mr. members of the committee, if, let's assume that the major sunsets on January 1st, at least the portions of the major at issue and sunset on January 1st, 2004, and a claim, let me check the, and a claim had been in the pipeline at that point and therefore remained unpaid when the remaining funds were transferred to the highway fund. That claim would be a claim which had not been paid by the bond, so or rather by the fund. So the way I would read the -5 A5 amendments would be that the consumer's claim against the fund has been finally settled. There's no money to pay that. The authority to pay from the fund no longer exists. And so under the A5 amendments, the consumer would be thrown back on whatever was remaining of the bond.
Unpaid if the bond was unavailable at that point. But the state general fund and the highway trust funds would be left, in your opinion, a cursory review of this, would be left basically indemnified from anything beyond the $700,000. After the act terminates.
Sure, as to the highway trust fund, I'm certain of that conclusion, and it would be my opinion that I haven't thought about this issue actually, but that in my opinion the general fund would not have liability because the authority for making the payment would expire on January 1st of 2004.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepard. I appreciate that information. Any questions for Mr. Shepard before we thank you?
Not a question, but kind of a comment. If the legislature at that point decided to let the act sunset, I would assume the legislature would also, be part of a legislative discussion. And if there was new legislation that would be needed at that point to ensure the transition to the sunset, I think the sunset would trigger an opportunity for the legislature to address what are the issues surrounding this fund, and either are we going to continue it and extend the sunset, or are we going to create some form of a transition to allow the fund to proceed. So I think there's an opportunity, if it's going to sunset, to look at what are the issues surrounding the sunset and addressing
that legislative session at that time.
could address that.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess one thing I would like to make sure is that there is a possibility at that time that dealers, if there was a tail coverage that was substantial unfunded, would there be a possibility that dealers under paragraph under the first on page 3, which is section 2, part 3, that special assessment, that special assessment basically goes away, so they have no ability to go back against the dealers on a $300 a year assessment until such time as that's made up if it was unfunded.
Section 3 is the bill
that one vote
did
which would be gone.
Okay.
Well, this one question. Mr. Shepard, why are these two things related? Why do we need the increasing the titling fee in this bill? Couldn't we do it without that? Why are these two things together in this bill?
Sure. Senator Trowe, two parts to the answer. First, it is not an increase in the title fee, and I think it's important to understand that that's the fee that the dealer collects in order to provide those various services. And the answer to the question, frankly, is that we don't see that this is part of a compromise that arose from the work of the working group. It is certainly conceivable that the
you could create an insurance company or whatever we're going to call them without having that title fee there. It was part of a compromise that the issues are unrelated. One doesn't necessarily have to go with the other.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, both issues relate to vehicle dealers and so are properly within the relating clause of the bill, but you're correct that they are different concepts and indeed one could draft a recovery fund without the other piece and vice versa.
So they needed just simply to attract enough support among the sponsors of the bill to get the bill out here.
Chair Senator Trowe, our experience in several legislative sessions and efforts to increase the bond is that all the interested parties have a checkmate on all the other parties. And in the absence of some grand compromise, we can't do anything for consumers, and that's why the Department of Justice arrived where it is today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepard. And behind the dais, Legislative Council has stepped forward, Greg Shamoff, who has overheard part of the conversation, and he assures me that his opinion at this point is that of corroborates the information provided to us by Mr. Shepard, and that is that the Highway Trust Fund would be exempt from any intrusion by any additional liability that may be occasioned by tail coverage. And tail coverage is something I'm familiar with, having retired from accounting firm recently and having had to buy a bond for anywhere from 1 to 3 years to make sure that tail coverage is there. So I appreciate that information.
And did Mr. Shamoff say the general fund was also immune from that?
He did not. He did not. And Senator, I think that Representative Hansen's analysis is probably the correct analysis, and that is that if there appeared to be a substantial tail coverage and the consumers were somehow adversely affected beyond the $700,000, I would think that the legislation would have to act upon that, or they would just, the consumers would basically end up as the losers if the tail was not sufficient.
Well, somebody said, Mr. Shepard said he thought the bond would pick it up.
Now, the bond that he was referring to, Senator, I think is the dealer's bond that is presently covered in statute, which is the $25,000 that's on the...
There may not be enough money there to pick up everything.
And the testimony which we had yesterday was that the bond by the consumer is accessed after the lawsuits and running and judging and executing itself and so forth, which is a rather lengthy process. Well, we've got the bonding folks here. Mr. Paul, you represent a bonding firm? Okay. Tell me, if you would, please, relative to the accessing a bond, the 80% of dealer to dealer, how do they access a bond as opposed to the consumer?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the businesses would access the bond in the same way under this as the consumer would. They would either go file a claim or give information to this bonding company that this party that they bonded has committed an act that would be would qualify under the bond, or they would go to court and win a lawsuit. So they could go at it either of those two ways.
Excuse me, Mr. Bell. Just to refresh you, we've got 10 a.m. work session that's required on a couple of bills, and that's just in 5 minutes. Senator,
you want me to stay for that?
Well, the House will have to.
I was just trying to close this up, be there on time, but that's okay.
Yeah, we've got some only exercises in our floor that they wanted to participate in, and we're basically being excluded from as well. So.
You can't start for 10 because
no, that's exactly right. Mr. Powell, can you give us the Reader Digest version of the balance of the testimony?
Chairman, on the following three sheets, beginning with the one that with a highlight of why we opposed House Bill 2734, there's a series of information that we believe indicates why House Bill 2734 is the wrong approach to resolve this problem. Simply paying more money invites people to ask for more. It doesn't get to the source of this problem. And there are many examples of things that could be and probably should be done in order to improve the situation for consumers. As I pointed out on the first page, DMV is very much understaffed in terms of their investigators. I think the testimony was they have 5. If that was addressed, it would not only get at the dealers who are covered under this act, but all of those that are excluded. It would get at RV dealers. It would get at mobile home and manufactured housing dealers. It would get at dealers who are operating illegally, which this bill exempts as well. So going about that would get to the source of the problem, and that is finding people who are in trouble before the consumer gets in trouble. The second thing is we think the law should be strengthened in giving more authority to keep people out of the business from the state's point of view. And it's been mentioned that people go out of business, cause problems, get back into business. And we think that section of the law needs to be strengthened dramatically.
Mr. Powell, can I ask you one question? And this, I really want to get to the heart of it. Early on, it was indicated that the bonding companies were represented and weren't represented, and then really didn't have a great deal of input. We've got a problem. Is there a solution that is that you can encapsulate for us?
Mr. Chairman, probably it's kind of the things I just talked about. One of the solutions would be to limit claimants on the bond and increase the penal sum of the bond. That could be done if you eliminate the majority of people who are currently claiming on the bond, that is businesses who have other methodologies of protecting themselves, and limit the recovery of the bond to consumers. You could increase the penal sum of the bond substantially under the law, and that would be one way. We would think there would probably be other ways of setting up guarantee funds similar to those that the insurance industry is under. If an insurance company, a property tax insurance company goes broke, the other companies are assessed based on their market share to pick up the claims activity. Then that way you avoid the overhead of actually establishing a recovery fund that's got ongoing administrative costs and that sort of thing. You only invoke it when it's necessary, and the people who are paying it are the governing board in that case, and they handle the claim.
So statutorily right now, the $25,000 bond was given. Demands a greater coverage. The surety bond demands a greater coverage than just to protect the consumers.
Exactly.
Okay. Was that discussed in the work sessions?
Mr. Chairman, I was not at all of those work sessions, and I can't say that it wasn't. The ones I was at, it was not, because it was always directed at proposals that the Department of Justice had on the table. So there was, I didn't have a, I don't know whether it was discussed in any detail.
Okay. That may get to the heart of some of the issue. And capitalize the problem in that fashion. Mr. Bowe?
Mr. Chairman, Brian Bowe, representing Western Surety. I understand you're under time constraints, and I won't. Mr. Powell has done a good job articulating our concerns on this. We believe that House Bill 2734 is the wrong approach at this time. That if the committee or the legislature is truly interested in solving this problem, they need to look at the front end of the problem, at keeping the people who shouldn't be in the business out of the business, either through the means that Mr. Powell just discussed, or through simply finding the political will to raise the bonding level to the level such where that the underwriting and scrutiny applied to bond applicants keeps people that maybe shouldn't be in a fraud-sensitive business, like car sales is, out of that business. But we believe that it's entirely wrong at this time to go and abandon those efforts and to go on the back end of the problem and create a huge payout fund to try to deal with the problem.
Sure. Senator, maybe the Attorney General is just more realistic than everybody is. They realize that somehow or other we don't do those common sense things and spend the money for the vehicles so they can investigate and create those barriers up front to keep people out. So this is the only way we can do it, is to find some method of helping the consumer, who is the person most victimized by this, because it looks like the other people who have the good lawyers and can get at the bond, get all the bond money, and there's nothing left over for the consumer. And there needs to be some way to get money for the consumer. I don't know that what we have proposed is the best way, but I don't see any way to get there unless we do what you say, but we probably aren't going to do what you say. And that's too bad.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond just briefly, Mr. Senator Crow, added to the testimony that I've given you is a series of quotes from articles that talk about other state funds, which, I think point to the fact that this is not the right approach to try to resolve this kind of issue, and that the others that I suggested are, and I think politically they are as realistic as creating a state-controlled insurance company to make these kinds of claims.
You're probably right, except I don't know that somehow or other you guys have to help us get galvanized to do that.
Chairman, we'll work on that.
I might add that this proposal has had a curious course, because early on, at Mr. Fuller and his client's instigation, Mr. Powell and I met with them to discuss in detail our opposition to the recovery fund process. But as an alternative, the bill which was discussed earlier that raised the bonding level, which changed the cycle of dealer licensure in order to try to free up resources within DMV to increase enforcement, originally that was our whole approach, and that's where we were going on this to address the front end. Midstream, the document processing enticement was thrown into the discussion, and lo and behold, we had a different set of positions on our hands. And so we never walked down that path for the discussion because of that.
Colleagues, we're out of time, but I do want to call your attention to the fact that we do have a revised fiscal, which indicates the fiscal impact of between $43,000 and $82,000 relative to the impact of the fund, and you can review that, and then we'll schedule back as necessary as available. And I'm not sure whether the Senate has any appetite to meet on Saturdays until we're trying to guide it. We'll keep it on the schedule and continue to work. And senators work much harder than members of the House.
Twice the
yes, sir. And I
think they're more adept at tail coverage issues.
Excellent. Representative Hanselman, I support that, man. For the members, I want you to know that I did like tail coverage, and what I'm going to do is I'm retired from full-time practice, and I'm going to address this issue in the interim with the parties if we do not bring a resolution to it during this legislative session.
We will go ahead and close this portion of the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2734. We will open a work session on House Bill 2133. Christy Nickram is our Legislative Assistant Office Representative, and Jamie Chen is our clerk. Thank you, Jamie. Christy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. We're handing out copies of the Ian Gross copy of 2133 and some amendments to that bill, and copies of staff measure summaries and the fiscal impact statement. The amendments, do you want me to explain the claim of right?
Would you please, relative, the claim of right is a doctrine that basically gives you an opportunity to, whatever you have paid in to a fund at some particular point, income taxes or otherwise, if you find at a later time that there's some offset to it, then you have the claim of right to come back to it, based upon one person's enrichment over the other person's payment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if you, for instance, had a lump of money income in 1998 and you pay taxes on it, and then in 1999 you discover that it was a mistake and you had to send that money back, then you have a claim of right. And federal law and Oregon law don't agree as to how you treat that claim of right. When you have to pay the money back, Oregon only allows a deduction, and you can't always get all of your income tax back that way. Under federal law, you have either a deduction or a credit, and this measure 2133 will change it so that it agrees more with federal law.
Department of Revenue wants this and are agreeable at the same time. Mr. Chair, I move the A4 amendment to House Bill 2133. I was trying to facilitate things. The Department of Revenue apparently wants these changes made. With the work session, I move the dash A4 amendment.
Let me just ask, these were approved. Representative Jensen met with me on the House floor yesterday briefly about this bill, and the claim of rights doctrine I thought had been incorporated in the last session for federal. So the conceptual amendments dash A4 for House Bill 2133 have been moved. Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we will go ahead and incorporate the A4 amendments to set our
end. I move the amended bill if it's ready.
Senator Schill now moves the full bill the bill as amended, 2133 is amended the A4 amendment, through the full ways and means. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Again, I thought that had been done in the last session, that the Claim of Rights Act and federal law was state law was near federal law, so that the Claim of Rights Act and federal was the Claim of Rights Act and state, but evidently it's...
Now are they the same with the...
It should be the same now, the Claim of Rights
Act. I could do it so, and
Senator Crowe, would you like part of this?
Okay.
Thank you very much. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2133, and we will open the work session on Senate Bill 38 related to the matter of interpreters. Robin Lamont is here to represent the Legislative Fiscal Office.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. For some reason, I thought this was coming into the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee, so please forgive me that my memorandum is addressed to the wrong subcommittee. What you have in front of you is a hand and gross version of Senate Bill 38A. Senate Bill 38A sets up a process for statewide certification of interpreters for both administrative and court hearings.
The Handy Gross version that you have in front of you removes the general fund that's attached to my memo.
Oh, okay, I think so.
It removes the general fund appropriation in Section 9 and removes the emergency clause because the remainder of the bill is effective July 1, 2001. The reason for removing the general fund appropriation is that Senate Bill 5511, the end of session reconciliation bill, will include $200,000 for this process. And that budget, the budget report for that bill will include the following language. A comment that directs the Department of Administrative Services and the Judicial Department to report to the Emergency Board when an interim work plan for a work group has been developed, at which time the $200,000 may be allocated to the Judicial Department, and a budget note that directs the Director of the Department of Administrative Services and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to designate equal numbers of members to participate in an interpreter certification work group to assist the Department in the design of a statewide interpreter certification program and to develop recommendations for 2001 and 2003.
This is your understanding, that what we'll be doing then is that the work group would report at, for all levels of state agencies throughout the entire state, the interpreter certification program.
Plan, right.
Okay.
And the issues, the budget note and the budget report comments will be discussed in 5511. I just wanted this committee to understand how these two bills are linked. So this committee does not need to deal with either the budget budget report comments or the budget note, simply to understand why the general fund appropriation is being removed from Senate Bill 38.
But because
we're on place also.
Yes.
Okay. Do we need a conceptual amendments to the bill, or just to accept the hand and go for it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, you can accept the hand and gross version. Council has, in effect, given me the drafted copies. It's just not quite ready yet.
It's been moved by Senator Ferrioli that we accept the hand and gross portion of the conceptual amendments as presented by Legislative Fiscal Office, and that's approved by any other substitute committee that's there. Are there any objections to the hand and gross with the conceptual amendment? Hearing and seeing none, we will incorporate those modifications into Senate Bill 38A with those amendments. Those would be there. A4.
A3.
Okay. Are there any other questions concerning the issues relative to their address in Senate Bill 38?
Move it to the forward move of the discussion.
Senator Fairbairn now moves as amended today, Senate Bill 38, A and Gross, moves to the forward move of due path recommendation. Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we will so ordered. And Senator Ferrioli, are you comfortable doing that?
With pleasure, Mr.
Let's see. Does it need to go to the Senate?
It has to go to both houses.
Okay. Would you like to, Representative Hansen would like to go ahead and take that to the House.
Mm-hmm.
And to the Senate, Senator Ferrioli, would you like to do that?
I would ask is that Senator Gordley would like to carry that. I think it would be
very good. Let's put Senator Gordley in and confirm that with her. I think that would be very appropriate. I know she's worked hard on this one.
Thank you,
Thank you. With that having been completed, we will go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 38. A and Gross, and thank you very kindly. I appreciate the kindness and working with us.